The World is brought to you by Progressive, where customers who save by switching their home and car save nearly $800 on average. Quote at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who save with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary. Support for The World comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/the world. That's odoo.com/the world.
In Haiti, earthquakes, hurricanes, kidnappings, and now this.
We are down to a quarter tank, and there are no gas. There are no diesel, no gasoline right now.
Why gas pumps in Haiti are running dry. Also, health workers scramble to vaccinate all corners of the globe. That includes in war zones.
We cannot simply have a universal approach. We'll need to focus our attention on countries that are the most vulnerable for infection and therefore mutation.
I'm Marco Werman, and the story of a Palestinian teenager put in jail by Israel for nearly a year. He grew to hate Israelis.
I was boiling. I was mad. I should have do something.
Then a chance encounter with a group of Jews changed his thinking. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It is good to have you with us. We begin today in Haiti, a country that is, on top of its many troubles, running out of gas. Gangs are blockading fuel supplies at ports located in areas they control. It is a brazen display of force in a country still reeling from the assassination of its president in July. The World's Monica Campbell reports from Haiti on how the shortages are upending daily life.
The fuel shortage in Haiti is a big challenge right now, and I experience it firsthand as soon as I meet up with Harold Isaac, a local journalist I'm working with.
We are down to a quarter tank, and there are no gas. There are no diesel, no gasoline right now, and this is a reality right now.
Isaac is Haitian-Canadian and lives with his family in the capital, Port-au-Prince. He needs his pickup truck for work and to take care of his family. And now he's in the same bind as everybody else. He starts calling friends to see if anybody has some spare diesel. His friend promises to get back to him, and Isaac, like so many others in Haiti, will continue to hunt for fuel.
It's like this is liquid gold now. So many big businesses have already shut down.
Liquid gold, because gangs have managed to take control of the supply. This week, a top gang leader in Haiti tweeted he'd only release his grip on fuel deliveries if Haiti's interim prime minister resigns. So far, Haitian officials are saying little about how they'll resolve this crisis. Fuel truck drivers and bus and taxi drivers are fed up and going on strike. They refuse to venture through gang territory and risk getting hijacked or kidnapped by groups like the one that took the U.S. and Canadian missionaries hostage this month. Isaac has lived through fuel shortages before, but says this one is severe.
To me, the gas crisis is symptomatic of all the woes of Haiti right now. It's how theoretical of a state Haiti is today.
The shortages are also putting people's lives at risk. Many Haitian hospitals depend on generators to keep the lights on and oxygen tanks running. Now, some hospitals may have to close entirely. Susanna Balbo is in Haiti with UNICEF, the UN's children's agency.
It's impossible to plan at this moment because we are planning day by day.
UNICEF has been trying to get fuel delivered to hospitals, but providers are backing out because of security concerns. Balbo worries about the people who aren't getting medical care.
All the people that are sick, that may need to go to the hospitals, all the children that are in pain. So this is really affecting everyone.
At one gas station in Haiti, a large crowd gathers around pumps, hoping for a fuel delivery. Some people sit and wait, holding empty yellow jugs. It's hot and humid, intense. An armed security guard in a blue uniform stands watch. We speak away from the crowd. He asks to use his first name only, Jeremy, because the station's owner isn't around to grant permission.
Pour moi-même et nous de sécurité, OK? Nous pas faire service à vous. Parce qu'on peut nous bousculer.
Jeremy says he feels overwhelmed. Once he says the police came to help and fired some shots in the air when the crowd got too big. That didn't solve anything, he says. He wants the government to do more, but also thinks officials are outmatched by the gangs. Haiti should ask another country for help, he says. The fuel shortages are also testing his own family. His dad's a cab driver and stuck at home, he says. No gas. Closer to the pumps, one young woman, Irene Devayu, is taking advantage of the crowds and the heat. She's selling shaved ice drenched with cherry and passion fruit syrup. But she might not be able to do this for long. She has to take a cab to haul her heavy cooler of ice, and no gas means no cab and then no income. As for journalist Harold Isaac, dozens of phone calls pay off.
The good news is that we found some diesel. Okay, my tank takes 10 gallons.
A friend of a friend found Isaac 4 gallons of diesel at about $7.50 a gallon. A small fortune here, but Isaac's relieved. Eventually, a man meets Isaac in a parking lot. He's carrying one of those yellow plastic jugs. This one's full.
How much is it?
5 gallons. A jug of 5 gallons.
They cut a water bottle in half to create a makeshift funnel. It's unwieldy. Some of the fuel starts spilling on the ground, and another guy comes over to help. Once it's all in, Isaac starts his car and exhales.
Well, yes, I'll be good for a few days until the next time.
Good, until the next time his tank runs empty. For The World, I'm Monica Campbell, Port-au-Prince, Haiti.
When it comes to vaccinating people for COVID, conflict zones have been at the bottom of the priority list. In places like Somalia, Mali, and Yemen, the challenges could not be greater. But as The World's Ilana Gordon reports, we can't afford to overlook these places.
In March of 2020, when the pandemic was just setting in, the United Nations Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, made this plea.
I am calling for an immediate global ceasefire in all corners of the world.
He asked for warring groups to pull back so that life-saving care could enter.
It is time to put armed conflict on lockdown and focus together on the true fight of our lives.
It was a really powerful, unprecedented call to action. But Claude Broederlein, director of the Center of Competence on Humanitarian Negotiations, says it just didn't happen. Today, vaccination efforts in conflict areas have barely started. The rates are somewhere between 0 to 2%.
Hundreds of millions of people live in these countries, and there is no real understanding of the reality of vaccination of these countries.
Providing vaccinations and life-saving care to people in conflict zones is hard. Health workers have to build trust with all sides. They have to maintain an appearance of neutrality. And then there's the logistical challenges. Needed infrastructure and health facilities have often been destroyed, like in Yemen and Syria. War displaces people, including essential health workers. But here's the thing. Vaccinating people is possible.
The essence of a successful smallpox campaign is to quickly find outbreaks of the disease and contain them.
In the 1960s and 70s, the WHO smallpox campaign made it into conflict zones. The disease was the first to be fully eradicated from the world. In the 80s and 90s, UNICEF successfully negotiated short periods of peace in Central America that allowed polio vaccines and other essential immunizations to hundreds of thousands of kids. Public health journalist Madeline Drexler says these moments of peace would become a model for other vaccination efforts. It became known as Days of Tranquility.
Which is such a poetic phrase, but I think in the context of COVID-19, it's a really wrenching phrase because there are so many obstacles right now.
The nature of conflict is changing. Groups aren't negotiating with one or two state actors anymore. Esperanza Martinez directs the COVID-19 response for the International Committee of the Red Cross. She says today about 50 million people live under full control of non-state armed groups, and another 100 million are in areas that are in and out of conflict.
It means that access to these populations and for these people to access health services, there is a negotiation with a significant number of armed groups, many of them with different objectives, different beliefs.
The vaccine is also going to adults first. This is new. And then there's education, addressing vaccine hesitancy, and just what COVID is to begin with and why people should care.
Keep physical distance, but stay in touch with your family members.
In conflict regions like in the Democratic Republic of Congo and Mali, the Red Cross made radio PSAs like this one in English and Swahili to raise awareness.
Kuwa na nambari za simu au anwani za barua pepe za wapendwa wako.
But they're competing against a lot of misinformation and disinformation and general distrust of authorities and even humanitarian groups. In areas of Somalia, armed groups have declared their opposition to vaccine programs. Health workers are facing death threats. But Claude Broderline says the biggest barrier is easy to address. It's getting them the vaccines so they can plan and build trust. He says it's time to rethink the whole global distribution strategy.
You know, if we want to really address the pandemic and to look into ways to enhance our strategy to prevent mutation, for example, we cannot simply have a universal approach. We'll need to focus our attention on countries, populations that are the most vulnerable for infection and therefore mutation.
Without addressing this, he says, the world will continue to give the virus an edge. For the World, I'm Alana Gordon.
The World recently spoke with Claude Broderline and others for a Facebook Live event with Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Watch the video of that discussion about vaccinations in conflict zones on our website, theworld.org. We want to take a few minutes to remember groundbreaking comedian Mort Saul, who died yesterday at the age of 94 at his home outside San Francisco. According to the Library of Congress, the Canadian-American comic recorded the earliest modern stand-up routine on record. It's remarkable when you think about it. In the late 1950s, comedy in the U.S. was mostly setups that led to punchlines. Take my wife, please, that kind of thing. Mort Saul got up on stage, a newspaper tucked under his arm, and basically extemporized on politics and foreign affairs, and revolutionized stand-up, sticking it to politicians on the right and left a half century before the likes of Jon Stewart or Bill Maher arrived on the scene. Here's Saul in 1960 on The Ed Sullivan Show. As background, JFK was not yet president, and Taiwan was called Formosa.
Senator Kennedy is in favor of foreign aid, and some of the Republicans feel that it's spending. That's been their attitude. And Senator Kennedy always says, well, it'll stop communism, the foreign aid. And then he has adequate documentation. For instance, he pointed out that earlier this year, the Red Chinese tried to invade Formosa and found to their frustration that they could not get past the American supplies on the beach.
Mort saw their pantomiming GIs playing volleyball on the beach. Later that same year, also on The Ed Sullivan Show, Mort Saul riffed on the Korean War and shed some light on his own story.
I was in the Korean War, which we called at the time World War 2.4. Remember this? The Korean War was supposed to be between the UN and the Koreans. I never saw any Koreans. I was in a remote outpost. All I saw were Americans and Chinese. And then sometimes on Sunday when the fighting was slow, the Koreans would come up with their families, you know, watching and refreshments. But no supplies. We took it almost that seriously. No supplies, no ammunition, no gasoline, but you could buy them. That was one of the conveniences. So if you came from a wealthy endowment, a family, and you had a personal grudge, you could press the war. This didn't make for the best morale. And one day when we were in sub-zero weather, I remember saying offhand, because there was nothing to talk about at that point, I said something about, because you remember, the Korean War didn't quite end or start. You just kind of went there. And when you came home, nobody knew you'd been gone. You could tell because none of the girls got married. That's always an index.
There's a punchline. Mort Saul, age 94. If we have ended up today with a lot of comedy about nothing, know that it began with comedy about something. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We are just days away from the UN's major global climate change conference in Glasgow. It's been dubbed a make or break to keep climate change under check. President Biden has been hoping to attend this conference with a domestic climate bill under his belt. Here he is speaking to reporters on Monday. The question, will he have a plan before Wednesday, i.e. today?
Do you think you'll have a plan before Wednesday?
With the grace of God and the goodwill of neighbors.
But the climate policy embedded in a $1.5 trillion spending bill is being held up by Democratic Senator Joe Manchin from West Virginia. Manchin opposes a policy that would reward energy providers for using renewable sources and penalizing those that don't. Many of the other climate provisions in Biden's original plan have also been removed. Hope is fading quickly that the I's will be dotted before Biden leaves for Glasgow this week. So how will Washington's inability to get things done play out in Glasgow? To discuss that, we're joined by Chris Venables. He's the head of politics for the UK think tank Green Alliance and joins us from London. So there's still a small window for some change, but this is a very possible scenario, Chris, of Biden showing up in Glasgow without a domestic climate deal. How much does that hurt American credibility?
I think it does hurt US credibility. The US is 15% of global emissions. That's no small number. Obviously, the package has been shrunk. There's been bits that have taken out of it. There are some really progressive bits, which we've seen weakened and removed. But it's still worth saying that a $500 billion package, which is what we understand is still on the table, is still a big win. We all have our fingers crossed that when Biden takes the stage in Glasgow next week, that he's got something to show for it.
The Biden White House also points to a lot of success being done at state houses around the U.S. with tight zero emission targets. Do other countries take notice of that?
Definitely. I mean, I can remember the day of President Trump withdrawing from the Paris Agreement, and that was a devastating moment for many of us who'd worked on this agenda for a long time. But we took so much hope from, you know, the likes of California and others pressing ahead and showing that it can be done. And so I think that is exciting, and people do take note of that.
Do you see any parallels between what's happening politically in the US right now and other countries you're watching?
We've seen this kind of dynamic play out across the world. Indeed, we see it here in the UK as well, where, you know, spending plans are watered down. We had our budget today, and we saw the Chancellor, Rishi Sunak, kind of water down what initial hopes for a green spending plan. But I think, I think it's politics that things have to kind of get shrunk and compromises have to be made. So, yeah, I think that kind of democratic problem is a really striking one that we're going to have to keep grappling with, and no easy answer.
I mean, in your view, Chris, how much compromise is acceptable when the conditions like unprecedented heat waves or fires and storms, they demand urgent and uncompromising decisions? I mean, do you worry that the slow pace of democracy is kind of unable to face a challenge of the climate crisis?
We need to halve global emissions this decade to keep the 1.5 target on the table. And those people who are blocking that need to have a serious answer for how we do that. And it is deeply frustrating when there isn't an answer to that, when these packages and proposals are watered down.
Some leaders of heavily emitting countries will likely not be attending the conference, though, like Chinese President Xi Jinping and Russian President Vladimir Putin. How are you feeling right now, Chris, about the politics of COP26?
It's a real mixed bag. I mean, just to say, Russia and China will, you know, still be sending hundreds of diplomats and ambassadors will be there. So it's not that they're kind of not taking part. It will be difficult, not least because one of the kind of key negotiating issues is whether countries like the US, developed countries, pay for and support the transition in developing countries. And we've seen that kind of key goal missed this week. And that kind of sets quite a difficult negotiating context. But as ever, there will be a COP next year. It'll be hosted by Africa. And these processes do keep going. So it doesn't all have to be done in Glasgow. But obviously, time is running out.
Chris Venables is head of politics for the UK think tank Green Alliance. He joined us from London. Chris, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks.
Like many people, I don't put that much thought into the water I drink. I filter, but the water is my city's. If I'm feeling fancy, it's over ice. But a small group of professionals is out to show people that water has taste, and it deserves much more attention. The world's Bianca Hillier introduces us to some of the very few water sommeliers across the globe.
Christina Lee is the first and only water sommelier in Canada. and she's used to the look of surprise when she tells people what she does for a living.
Usually they would say, what? What are you talking about, water sommelier?
Simply put, a water sommelier is just the water version of a wine sommelier, someone who is an expert in the taste and characteristics of wine. There are at least 100 water sommeliers around the world, and they've all gone through official training to know what makes one water different from the next. So I asked Lee to guide me through a virtual tasting to explain all of this in detail.
We do a flight of distilled water first, okay?
First up is a water called Penta, which has gone through a lengthy 13-step purification process.
So what do you think?
It tastes like water.
It tastes like water.
Nothing to write home about. At this point, I'm not sure I'll be able to pick up on the variations. Then I took a sip of a different water called Starkey.
All right, take a sip.
Yeah.
Oh, that is completely different.
Do you feel that you're finally eating fresh vegetables instead of like processed frozen vegetables,
yes,
in a sense?
Yes. If I were to drink water from a stream... This tastes like what I might expect.
Exactly.
Turns out that water actually is from a geothermal spring. It hasn't been filtered as much as the first water, so it still contains all of its minerals and therefore tastes so different. Lee walked me through 5 still and 3 sparkling waters. Some were kind of salty. Another left my mouth feeling dry. Basically, most of the differences in taste are because of where the water is from and what minerals it contains. Calcium, potassium, magnesium, and silica all lead to different tastes. Candace Jansen is a water sommelier in Johannesburg, South Africa. She helps restaurants create water menus and food pairings. For example, water with a low mineral content and subtle taste, like Fiji water, would pair with
something like a sushi, a light salad, something that's not substantial in taste, not vibrant, not spicy, not salty, just kind of soft.
But if you're eating a steak, Jansen would pour you something totally different, like Vichy Catalan, which is kind of the champagne of sparkling water.
It's got a high sodium content, big bubbles. It really just brings that saltiness out of your meal.
But for many water sommeliers, including Jansen and Christina Lee, the job is about much more than taste. Water sommeliers are also water advocates. They work to increase access to clean water, teach people how to reduce waste, from plastic bottles to water that often just goes down the drain. And overall, they urge others to give water the attention it deserves. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
You're listening to The World. In a Spanish courtroom, the judge has ruled dogs are people too. Sort of.
I think it's very exciting. It is a definite example of changing attitude about our companion animals and acknowledging how more and more they really are part of the core family.
Just don't tell the cat. That's coming right up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Israel announced that it is moving ahead with its plan to build 3,000 new homes for Jewish settlers in the West Bank. The U.S. reaction was swift, the harshest public criticism of Israel from the Biden administration to date. Here's State Department spokesman Ned Price.
We are deeply concerned about the Israeli government's plan to advance thousands of settlement units Wednesday, many of them deep in the West Bank.
Israel's occupation of the region has been the source of division and violence for decades, something we've been exploring on our program. Yesterday, we heard the story of a former Israeli soldier who used to patrol the West Bank. Today, we're meeting a Palestinian man who fought on the other side. Osama asked us to use only his first name. Revelations about his prior criminal activity could jeopardize his applications for travel visas. Reporter Shana Sheely spoke with Osama for the podcast, The Spiritual Edge.
In the Palestinian town of Jericho, customers cycle in and out of Osama's cell phone shop to buy new SIM cards. Osama sits behind a desk, clicking through YouTube music videos.
Here, it's written, Intifada 1987.
He plays me one of his favorites. It's about Palestinians during the first Intifada. It was popular when he was young.
It's just childhood, it's just my life.
Around his left wrist, he wears three strands of olive pits. He carved them into beads when he was a teenager, in prison. He plays me another song, one he listens to when he can't sleep, and he has many sleepless nights. Shalom Aleichem is a tune that Jewish people sing on the Sabbath, calling on the angels of peace. The lyrics are in Hebrew.
Every time I hear it, always I feel relaxed.
For years, Osama hummed the hymn without knowing its lyrics or what the song was about. Growing up, he didn't know much about Jews or their songs. Walls divide much of the land and separate the people. Osama's early encounters with Israelis were during the first Palestinian uprising, or First Intifada, when soldiers patrolled outside his classroom. They wore uniforms and helmets.
And carrying M16 and don't speak our language. I was afraid to look at their faces, actually.
Every night before bed, Osama's mom gave him raw onions.
To keep it with us in the bed because it's against the tear gas, or the smell of the tear gas.
One night, when Osama was 13 years old, he woke up to the sound of two-way radios inside his house.
Like, shh, 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 shh. I was terrified. I beat on my pants. And then my father came and turned the light.
The soldiers grabbed his father's arm and took him. He didn't return until morning.
I saw my mother putting olive oil. She was putting in his hand and his back. I saw blue marks on his body. And for me, that was a big change in my life. It's like something boiling inside you, like maybe a volcano boiling. Like there is no way to get out, and you want to release it. You want to feel better. And it feels much better when you do something.
Osama felt better when he was out with friends, throwing stones at tanks.
That was our daily life, every single day. This is the main.
For him, it wasn't a political thing.
Just to tell the soldiers, we are here, you are not breaking us.
One night, soldiers showed up in Osama's bedroom and took him to a prison in the north of Israel. It was when they locked him up that his political education began. He says fellow detainees ran a kind of seminar.
I learned more how to hate Jewish people.
Osama heard from other inmates how Jews forced Palestinians from their homes. They took their land. And now, here he was, just 15 years old, he says, in prison for throwing stones and hanging the Palestinian flag. He decided he'd spend the rest of his life fighting Jews. After nearly a year, Osama was released. He was never charged. In the early 1990s, a peace deal known as the Oslo Accords was signed. This ended the First Intifada.
Today, the leadership of Israel and the Palestine Liberation Organization will sign a declaration of principles on interim Palestinian self-government. It charts a course toward reconciliation between two peoples.
As part of the agreement, Palestinians were given more autonomy. This included establishing a police force, which Osama joined as a recruit. And for several years, he had hope that Palestinians and Jews could live side by side.
This brave gamble that the future can be better than the past must endure.
The idea of living peacefully with Jews came crashing down for Osama during a clash between Palestinians and Jewish settlers in the West Bank. He was there, he says, when his best friend was shot and killed by Israeli soldiers.
I was boiling. I was mad. I should have done something.
Osama vowed revenge. He quit his job as a policeman and joined the fight against Israel in what was the Second Intifada. It was much more violent than the first. Militias ran this fight. Osama helped them transport weapons and ammunition. He did other things he doesn't want to talk about. By the time the Second Intifada ended, thousands of people, Palestinians and Israelis, had died. Osama was now in his 30s. He spent most of his life fighting, and now he was beginning to wonder, what was the point of it all? During one of his lowest points, Osama ran into an old friend who invited him to a group dinner. Osama was stunned when they walked into a hotel dining room.
I saw someone wearing a yarmulke on his head, and I said, what is this Jewish guy doing here? And he said, he's part of the group. And I said, but he's Jew. And he said, all of them are Jews.
Osama walked out. He stood outside in the rain and lit a cigarette.
Something pulled me back. I don't know.
From a distance, Osama listened in on the meeting. He heard a former Israeli pilot talk about his time as a soldier in Gaza when he refused to fire at a building. Osama had never heard a Jew talk about having complicated feelings around anything.
I went back with the crack, with the big, like, let's say not big, but small crack in my mind, thinking like every night when I put my head on the pillow, how there is good Jewish people on this planet.
Months later, he showed up at another meeting with Israelis. A three-day retreat that led to a plan to invite Israelis to meet Palestinians. Osama immersed himself fully in the project. He estimates he guided more than 3,000 Israelis on tours of the West Bank. One evening, it was Osama who went to an Israeli friend's home for dinner, for Shabbat, the Jewish Sabbath. As everyone sat around the table, his hosts started singing.
I was choked and said, what is this song? Like, do you know it? No, I have heard it. No, maybe you heard it before, but why are you feeling it?
Osama was holding back tears.
I was forcing my body to calm down. What's going on with you?
He couldn't remember where he'd heard the song before or why it triggered such an emotional response.
And then I remembered where this came from. And then
he was 15 years old in an Israeli prison in solitary confinement.
It's dark, it's stinky, it's hard floor. Your body is not giving you opportunity to rest because you have to stay awake to take care of it.
All these years later, Osama realized that the song that brought him so much comfort, helped him through some of his most difficult times, was the song that soldiers outside his cell were singing, Shalom Aleichem, for the Sabbath.
And it was like, and then it goes with the wind and it comes back.
Today, Osama dedicates much of his time to organizing former Israeli and Palestinian fighters to end the Israeli occupation with a group called Combatants for Peace. This is the same group that Dean Izakharov, the Israeli profiled yesterday, belongs to. Group members rebuild schools the Israelis have demolished and speak to people all over this tiny divided land about what it's like to grow up on the other side of the wall.
A lot of people asked me in my talks, are you sorry for doing what are you doing? I'm not apologizing.
But he realized that throwing stones, shooting weapons, that didn't work. Israel's control over Palestinians has only tightened. So Osama changed his tactics.
When I visit a family, for example, in Israel, and we sit and talk and have food together, and I give opportunity to these kids to see a Palestinian as a human being, to see me as friend of their father. And the goal is they will accept me more, and they will understand my issue more and my narrative more, and that will make both of us safe. They will not come to attack me, and I will not attack them back, you know?
It's not always easy.
I do get angry, and that's why I keep doing this, because by violence I will not stop demolishing houses, but by peace, by putting this in public by going with Israelis together to rebuild their houses.
Years after he threw stones and picked up arms against Jewish Israelis, Osama now works with them to rebuild demolished houses and playgrounds, to share stories of growing up in a divided land, to bridge a deep divide. This is how Osama wages his resistance. For The World, I'm Shayna Sheely.
Shayna's story came from The Spiritual Edge, a podcast from KALW in collaboration with the University of Southern California's Center for Religion and Civic Culture. A court in Madrid has ruled that a couple, now separated, will have joint custody of their dog. The lawyer who brought the case says it was a, quote, pioneering ruling. That's because her client was able to declare herself not as a co-owner of the dog, but as a co-carer, as if the dog was a person. The dog named Panda will alternate between the two partners' homes for a month at a time. David Favor teaches property and animal law at Michigan State University and helped to draft the International Convention for the Protection of Animals. He joins us from East Lansing. Professor Favor, what do you make of this story from Spain?
I think it's very exciting. It is a definite example of changing attitude about our companion animals and acknowledging how more and more they really are part of the core family and therefore should be treated more like children, not identical, obviously, but more like children than they are like property.
I think for some people, this story will be seen as animals being taken too seriously, and yet it is a serious story. I mean, pets are so often seen as members of the family, but under law, they get treated like property. So how can laws recognize the difference between the family dog and, say, honestly, a living room chair?
Well, I think that in the United States, we are making that distinction now in the law. We now have four states that have changed the divorce law so as to require or allow the judge to take into account what's in the best interest of the animal, somewhat like they would for children. Now, understand that those laws don't change the property law. They're still property, but they're property law with extra attention.
So in your book, The Future of Animal Law, you devote a chapter to cases like this in the United States. Where is this headed in the U.S., and how does it compare to other nations?
While the Spanish court, that was the opinion of one judge. So it's an example of the direction more than the fact that it's actually changed the law. So it is happening around the world more and more. As our families get smaller, the companion animals get more important. And everybody recognizes it. Judges recognize that. You know, legislators recognize that. It's not a radical thing to say that for many people, their dog is their child, and therefore should get that sort of social status within our legal system.
Is this kind of litigation going on in other countries?
Yes. The question of what to do with dogs in divorce is an ongoing question that's being raised more and more around the world. But it's going to take a while for most states to transform their legislation to allow that to happen in an open manner. You're more or less dependent upon a particular judge agreeing with you and trying to make some accommodation for it.
When you say states, you mean countries, nation states.
Countries, yes.
David, what is the next frontier in law when it comes to recognizing animals as more than property? Like, where could this all go?
Well, there's two threads. One is in the courts. And in the United States, we have a series of cases in New York and in Connecticut on habeas corpus proceedings that try to declare that animals are persons. But the other way is in the legislature. And that's where, if they want to, they can raise the status and protection for animals. And that's primarily with the focus of domestic animals, whereas in the courts, it's the higher intelligent animals, the chimpanzees and the elephants.
But for right now, it seems more and more dogs are being viewed as people too. Is that kind of the takeaway?
That's right. I think so.
So, David, I'm curious, do you have pets? And I mean, just personally, what does this ruling in Spain mean for you?
Yes, I have pets, and I identify with the emotions that are tied to why people want to promote their interest when it comes to handling where the animal goes. So, yes, this is a step forward, and I would hope we could do the same thing where I live.
Professor David Favor teaches property and animal law at Michigan State University, helping us understand issues raised by a separation case in Spain that granted joint custody of the dog named Panda. David, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
100 days until this. The Beijing Winter Olympics. Beijing Vice Mayor Zhang Jiangdong spoke today to mark 100 days out from the big games. He said controlling COVID is the major challenge for the organizers. But it's not the only one for China. There's a boycott movement that isn't going away. A few weeks ago, human rights activists disrupted the ceremonial lighting of the Olympic flame. It's hard to hear, but this protester is shouting, how can Beijing be allowed to hold the Olympics given that they are committing genocide against the Uyghurs? Activists have taken to calling the Beijing Olympics the Genocide Games. Mandy McCone is the executive director of the International Tibet Network. She accused the International Olympic Committee of ignoring China's human rights record.
We've had meetings with the IOC. We've given them the evidence. We've spoken to them about the situation. The entire time, it's just fallen on deaf ears. The response from them has literally been to say, it's not our problem. We're not going to do anything about it.
In the meantime, the message from China is full speed ahead. Tomorrow on the world, China's efforts to keep COVID out, even with thousands of athletes set to come in. Kashmir is India's only Muslim-majority state. It is ruled by India, but Pakistan has long claimed it as their own. Since 1947, these two nuclear powers have gone to war over Kashmir three times. In the summer of 2019, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi scrapped Kashmir's semi-autonomous status, cut the internet for almost a year, and called in more Indian security forces who are empowered to enforce special security laws. Those laws, for example, allowed police in Kashmir to file charges against medical students for celebrating Pakistan's victory against India in a recent cricket match. The alleged crime? The cheering students committed anti-national activity. Kashmir is already on edge after the killing of dozens of civilians this year, some execution style. The attacks have mostly been against a small community of Hindus and Sikhs, but others have also been killed.
This latest episode of violence, the non-state actors actually started targeting also the Muslims who they thought were somehow collaborators or somehow aligning to the Indian state.
That's author and journalist Gohar Gilani, who is in Srinagar, the largest city in Jammu and Kashmir, the state's official name. Like many others, he fears that the killings are a return to the situation three decades ago, when militants in Kashmir drove out most of the religious minorities. Gilani is a veteran journalist who has worked and studied in Europe, and actually is supposed to be in Germany at his job at Deutsche Welle Radio. But as he told me, the special security laws in place prevent him from leaving Kashmir.
For me, it has meant that I was stopped from going to Germany again. So it was first attack on my own livelihood, and then I was stopped from travel. So many Kashmiris have actually been put on exit control list. They call it LOC, lookout circular. They do not allow, you know, anyone they think is an opinion maker or an academic or, you know, influential in his or her field. It also has taken a lot of psychological toll on you because you are not free. Censorship has actually become institutionalized. And then people also indulge in self-censorship. And they are scared of consequences if they write the ground reality or chronicle the ground reality.
So Gilani remains in Kashmir. He tried to convey what living in a heavily militarized region is like. There are Indian troops all across this Himalayan state, he says, and daily humiliations that take their toll on the Kashmiri population.
An eight-year-old girl, a Kashmiri girl, is being frisked by the Indian paramilitary troopers on the street. The women who travel in public transport, they are being stopped and made to line up. And then their identity cards are checked, their bags are checked, their, you know, wallets are checked. You know, psychiatrists say that the kind of influence such violence has on the mental health of people, it's also seen by people as violence.
In addition to the targeted killings of civilians in recent months, there are also shootouts between Indian forces and rebel groups. And then there is a kind of violence that Gilani believes lasts for generations, the destruction of homes where Kashmiri militants take shelter.
For a common Kashmiri, for example, if somebody's door is knocked and there are gun-toting armed rebels and they seek shelter in a house, so the house owner is sort of handicapped in a situation where he or she cannot resist. So once they take shelter or take food in this house, the next morning the Indian troops come and the gunfight starts and the entire house is razed to the ground and it's being blown up within minutes. So this becomes a cycle, vicious cycle of violence, and it feeds into the psyche of the next generation and the coming generations. So it's been a vicious cycle of violence for a very long time.
That's author and journalist Gohar Gilani, who currently lives in Srinagar in Kashmir. For the first time in 4 years, Egypt is no longer under a state of emergency. The government of President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi made the decision following years of criticism from human rights advocates. Whether the move will help imprisoned writers, lawyers, and activists, that is another question. Joining us now is Professor Samer Shahata. He's an associate professor in Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma and joins us from Washington. Samer, can you tell us why the state of emergency was put in place to begin with?
Well, the most recent state of emergency was put in place in 2017 after a series of bombings by an ISIS affiliate against churches in Egypt that left a number of people dead. But in reality, Egyptians have been living under a state of emergency for about 50 years, really, mostly on since 1967.
For the state of emergency imposed by President Sisi, who did it impact primarily?
Well, probably impacts the majority of people who are in prison for protesting. But it's also been used against, of course, Muslim Brotherhood leaders and supporters, liberals and people who supported the 2011 revolution, youth activists, journalists, you name it, anyone who's been willing to criticize the government.
So practically, what does it mean for the thousands of political detainees that the state of emergency has been lifted?
Well, it's not perfectly clear yet what it will mean for those who are already in jail, right? Because many of the high-profile people, we believe, who've gotten the most attention are still going to be subject to their detention and so on, and the court system that they have been, you know, subject to. It will hopefully end the special emergency state security courts that the emergency law allows. And it will hopefully, I mean, if it is to mean anything other than, you know, just this declaration, will allow a little bit of greater political space in Egypt. But that's certainly yet to be determined.
What do you think the lifting of the state of emergency now signals more generally about the Egyptian government? I mean, is this them rolling out a welcome mat for free expression or simply confidence that they're firmly in control of the country?
Well, they're firmly in control of the country, but I think what it is in response to is increasing criticism and some action by the international community about the human rights record and the state, the abysmal state of political freedom in Egypt. I mean, there's been intense criticism of the human rights record. And then, of course, very recently, the Biden administration withheld some aid, $130 million of aid, to the government. And the government has been, in response, trying to change its image, trying to kind of produce a makeover and to say that, you know, it's more interested in civil society groups, you know, human rights, and so on.
And some of those critics have been pretty relentless. Earlier this year, five leading human rights organizations in Egypt laid out some basic steps that should be taken to stop the erosion of human rights there. The lifting of the state of emergency, that was the first step. What are the next steps? And do you think the Egyptian government will continue the process?
Sure. I mean, they asked for a number of very concrete things. I mean, freeing political prisoners, for example. There are thousands of political prisoners. Stopping the detentions that kind of go on forever, staying all executions, political and criminal cases and so on, all kinds of other things. So those would really be much more kind of concrete actions. And therefore, I think, and many others are a little bit skeptical about what this really means in practice.
Samer Shahata is an associate professor in Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma, speaking with us from Washington. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.
Support for The World comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/theworld. That's odoo.com/theworld.